My name is Michael McCusker. I'd sort of like to start off this morning's program with a mention that Duncan Law, one of Astoria's most notable personages, has died at age 92. He died yesterday. And Caldwell's Loose Late Mortuary is in charge of funeral arrangements. Duncan Law was a highly intelligent and inventive person, particularly in marine fisheries and resources. I remember that I introduced him and Arthur Honeyman several years ago, and still regard that as a convergence of two especially remarkable human beings I have known. I wouldn't have been more pleased than if I had introduced Albert Einstein and Helen Keller. And Norman Doney has died in Warrenton. He was a veteran of three wars and spent much of the rest of his life helping provide equity for war veterans. Funeral services are today at Fort Stevens Post Cemetery in Hammond at 1 this afternoon. Well, I suppose that most of you are perhaps not only know about, but are getting pretty tired of hearing about the budget sequester, which is sequester, I guess you would better pronounce, that is going to begin to take effect tomorrow, March 1st. And I'd like to read a few articles that I've kind of pulled on what some of its effects just might be. I'll start with the New York Times editorial and their particular perspective from February 17th, 2013. The real cost of shrinking government. The budget sequester will soon affect American life in hundreds of painful ways. In less than 2 weeks, when this was written, because now it's going to be tomorrow, the 1st of March, a cleaver known as the sequester will fall on some of the most important functions of the United States government. About $85 billion will be cut from discretionary spending over the next 7 months, reducing defense programs by about 8% and domestic programs by about 5%. Only a few things will be spared, including some basic safety net benefits like Social Security, as well as paid for enlisted military personnel. The sequester will not stop to contemplate whether these are the right programs to cut. It is entirely indiscriminate, slashing programs whether they are bloated or essential. The military budget, for example, should be reduced substantially, but thoughtfully, considering the nation's needs. Instead, every weapons system, good or bad, will be hurt, as will troop training and maintenance. These cuts, which will cost the economy more than 1 million jobs over the next 2 years, are the direct result of the Republican demand in 2011 to shrink the government at any cost under threat of a default on the nation's debt. Many Republicans say they would still prefer the sequester to replacing half the cuts with tax revenue increases. But the government spending they disdain is not an abstract concept. In a few days, the cuts will begin affecting American life and security in significant ways. While some departments may have exaggerated the dire effects of their reductions, congressional budget experts say they have little doubt that the size and pervasive nature of the sequester will inflict widespread pain. Here are some examples from the government departments most affected. National Security. 2 week furloughs for most law enforcement personnel will reduce Coast Guard operations, including drug interdictions and aid to navigation, by 25%. Cutbacks in customs agents and airport security checkpoints will substantially increase passenger wait times, the Homeland Security Department said, creating delays of as much as an hour at busy airports. The Border Patrol will have to reduce work hours by the equivalent of 5,000 agents a year. The Energy Department's nuclear security programs will be cut by 900 million, $900 million, creating delays in refurbishing the weapons stockpile and cutting security at manufacturing sites. Environmental cleanup at nuclear weapons sites in Washington State, just up the river from us, Tennessee, South Carolina, and Idaho will be delayed. And remember, Hanford is already dealing with some once newly discovered leaks. Air traffic. About 10% of the Federal Aviation Administration's workforce of 47,000 employees will be on furlough each day, including air traffic controllers, to meet a $600 million cut. The agency says we'll be forced to reduce air traffic across the country, resulting in delays and disruptions, particularly at peak travel times. Criminal justice. Every FBI employee will be furloughed for nearly 3 weeks over the course of the year, the equivalent of 7,000 employees not working each day. The cut to the FBI of $550 million will reduce the number of background checks on gun buyers that the Bureau can perform and reduce response times on cyber intrusion and counterterrorism investigations. A cut of $338 million will mean more than a 2-week furlough for 37,000 prison employees. This will result in lockdowns at federal prisons across the country, increasing the chances for violence and risks to guards, and preventing the opening of 3 new prison buildings. Federal prosecutors will handle 2,600 fewer cases because of furloughs resulting from a $100 million cut. That means thousands of criminals and civil violators will not face justice, and less money will be collected in fines. Early childhood education. About 70,000 children will lose access to Head Start, and 14,000 teachers and workers will be laid off because of a $424 million cut. Parents of about 30,000 low-income children will lose child care assistance. Health and safety. A cut of $350 million to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will mean 25,000 fewer breast and cervical cancer screenings for low-income women, 424,000 fewer HIV tests, and the purchase of 540,000 fewer doses of vaccine for flu, hepatitis, and measles. Community health centers will be cut by $120 million, meaning that about 900,000 fewer patients lacking insurance will receive primary care. A 3-week furlough of all food safety employees will produce a shortage of meat, poultry, and eggs, pushing prices higher and harming restaurants and grocers. The Agriculture Department warns that public health could be affected by the inevitable black market sales of uninspected food. And you might have heard some of that on NPR Morning News this morning. Several air monitoring sites will be shut down, as will more than 100 water quality projects around the country. Around $100 million will be cut from Superfund enforcement, allowing companies to evade their responsibilities to clean up environmental disasters. Research. Nearly 1,000 grants from the National Science Foundation will be canceled or reduced, affecting research in clean energy, cybersecurity, and reform of science and math education. Recreation. National parks will have shorter hours, and some will have to close camping and hiking areas. Firefighting and law enforcement will be cut back. Defense personnel. Enlisted personnel are exempt from sequester reductions this year, but furloughs lasting up to 22 days will be imposed for civilian employees who do jobs like guarding military bases, handle budgets, and teach the children of service members. More than 40% of those employees are veterans. The military's health insurance program, TRICARE, could have a shortfall of up to $3 billion, which could lead to denial of elective medical care for retirees and dependents of active duty service members. Military operations. The Navy plans to shut down 4 air wings on March 1st, tomorrow. After 90 days, the pilots in those air wings lose their certifications, and it will take 6 to 9 months and much money to retrain them. The Navy has also said that the Nimitz and George H.W. Bush carrier strike groups will not be ready for deployment later this year because the service will run out of operations and maintenance money. This means the Truman and Eisenhower strike groups will remain deployed indefinitely, a decision affecting thousands of service members and their families. Continuous bomber flights outside of Afghanistan will be reduced, and there will be cutbacks to satellite systems and missile warning systems. Training and maintenance. The Army, which has done most of the fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, says it will be forced to curtail training for 80% of its ground forces, and that by the end of the year, two-thirds of its brigade combat teams will fall below acceptable levels of combat readiness. Air Force pilots expect to lose more than 200,000 flying hours. Beginning in March, roughly two-thirds of the Air Force's active duty combat units will curtail training at their home bases, and by July will no longer be capable of carrying out their missions. Some ship and aircraft maintenance will be canceled for the third and fourth quarters of the fiscal year, resulting in fewer available weapons. Senate Democrats produced a much better plan to reduce these cuts a couple of weeks ago, with a mix of new tax revenues and targeted reductions. About $55 billion would be raised by imposing a minimum tax on incomes of $1 million or more and ending some business deductions, while an equal amount of spending would be reduced from targeted cuts to defense and farm subsidies. Republicans immediately rejected the idea. The Senate Minority Leader, Mitch McConnell, called it, quote, a political stunt, unquote. Their proposal is to eliminate the defense cuts and double the ones on the domestic side, heedless of the suffering that even the existing reductions will inflict. Their refusal to consider new revenues means that on March 1st, tomorrow, Americans will begin learning how austerity really feels. And to run down the numbers again, domestic effects. 2,100 fewer food safety inspections would be conducted at domestic and foreign plants. 4,000 workers would be furloughed every day at the FAA, causing flight backups. 70,000 children would lose Head Start. The cuts also jeopardize 14,000 teachers and other school employees. 125,000 families would be put at sudden risk of homelessness because their rental assistance would end. 373,000 seriously mentally ill adults and severely emotionally disturbed children would most likely lose their treatments. 600,000 women and children would lose nutrition aid from the Women, Infants, and Children program. Military and security effects. 2,600 fewer criminal and civil cases would be handled by federal prosecutors because of staff reductions. 251,000 employees, civilians employed by the Army, could be furloughed for up to 22 days. $3 billion would be the potential shortfall in the military's health insurance program. Some services could be denied for retirees and dependents of active duty personnel. 25 and 470 ships and aircraft, respectively, would forego maintenance. And that was the New York Times editorial on Sunday, February 17th. And to get a little closer to home, the Daily Astorian also has this week an editorial from Tuesday, February 26th. Can we survive budget ectomy? Mutually incompatible perceptions drive the pending sequester. There are mutually incompatible ways of looking at the federal budget sequester bombshell set off to go this week, tomorrow. The president must be wondering how a negotiator can defuse a hostage crisis when the perpetrator doesn't care whether he and his hostage are harmed. On the other hand, congressional Republicans see the economy not as a hostage, but as a patient who needs painful surgery to reduce what they regard as cancerously large spending. But can the patient, the nation's still fragile economy, withstand a major budgetectomy right now? Is there an alternative? In Oregon, for example, we will lose about $10.2 million for K-12 schools, plus another $3 million for special ed. Combined, these cuts translate into about 220 fewer teachers, aides, and staff who work with thousands of students. About 3,000 civilian workers for the U.S. Department of Defense will start taking unpaid days off, subtracting $16.5 million from family budgets and local economies. Cuts in Army-based funding will result in about $1.6 million less spending in Oregon. Washington State, with its far greater share of national defense operations, will see military pay reductions of $173.4 million, Army base cuts of $124 million, plus other impacts to the Air Force and Navy. Other Oregon impacts include everything from loss of $690,000 for senior citizens' meals to $1.9 million for water and air quality and Head Start services for 600 kids. On one level, it might be appropriate for federal employees to share in the unpaid furloughs that have swept much of the private sector during the difficult recession and slow recovery. At the same time, these are not trivial cutbacks, particularly because they are unfocused across the board cuts. They do far more damage than necessary. In many cases, the services being reduced provide frontline assistance to vulnerable Americans. Reducing military spending makes perfect sense, but reducing pay for ordinary service personnel is the last thing most citizens want to see. Grossly expensive redundant weapons systems would be a far better target. Much of this peculiar congressional temper tantrum really revolves around GOP determination to block any additional tax adjustments on the wealthy. A new study by an analyst for the nonpartisan Congressional Research Service shows federal giveaways to the ultra-wealthy in the form of tax breaks on capital gains and stock dividends have cost lower-income taxpayers a fortune, greatly worsening class differences. Correcting this situation would be wise, just, fair, and totally unlikely, considering the congressional GOP's deference to the rich. The sequestration, sounds almost like castration, appears likely to happen. Once this shot has been fired, it's time to get serious about making sure future cuts and taxes land where they deserve. And that was editorial from the Daily Astorian this past Tuesday. Now I'd like to read something that was written in early January, Passive Resistance, and it seems to have been from the New York Times Company, by Andrew Rosenthal. It was January 4th. Following the fiscal cliff deal, if you remember that, at the beginning of the year, President Obama declared that he would not get into another fight over the debt ceiling. Nice idea, I thought, but fat chance. The congressional Republicans are already getting ready for that fight. In a couple of months, the president will ask us to raise the nation's debt limit, said Senator Mitch McConnell, the minority leader. We cannot agree to increase that borrowing limit without agreeing to reforms that lower the avalanche of spending that's creating this debt in the first place. That's the usual Republican disinformation. Mr. Obama is required by law to ask Congress to authorize more borrowing to cover debts on spending that Congress already authorized. The president makes no decision here. He just delivers the news. Mr. Obama's choices are limited. He can invoke the 14th Amendment and unilaterally raise the debt ceiling. The 14th Amendment says the government may take no action that calls into question, quote, the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law. But he has never shown the stomach for that kind of confrontation, and the White House has already ruled out that idea. His only other real choice, setting aside the trillion-dollar coin idea as too cute, is just as confrontational. It's to keep his word by simply refusing to enter into negotiations and telling the Republicans that the proverbial ball is in their court, that they can either vote to increase the debt ceiling or not, and risk both an economic collapse as well as the blame for a collapse. To make that work, Mr. Obama will have to forcefully counter Republican propaganda over the debt and the nature of the debt ceiling, which he hasn't done successfully in the past. And he'll have to stand firm, which he hasn't done successfully in the past. Some on the right, at least outside of the official party, are easing Mr. Obama's path by publicly acknowledging the weakness of the Republican position. The Wall Street Journal editorial page warned that if the GOP fights over the ceiling, Mr. Obama will say Republicans are risking national default and recession. Most of Wall Street will echo him, and the Treasury will maneuver to apply maximum political pressure, for example, by claiming it can't pay Social Security benefits. And that's the Wall Street Journal. And more to the point, the Journal said, you can't take a hostage you aren't prepared to shoot. Still, Mr. Obama should remember that if he makes any offer linked to the debt ceiling, he will have lost the war. He will end up negotiating with himself again, as he did over the fiscal cliff, and the debt ceiling nonsense will become a permanent part of budget talks. And that's an article titled Passive Resistance by Andrew Rosenthal, and it was written January 4th, 2013, and I guess appeared in the New York Times. And to another Times columnist, and who appears also in the Daily Astorian, so we're combining the two now, Paul Krugman, Sequester of the Fools. They're back. Just about 2 years ago, Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, the co-chairman of the late unlamented Debt Commission, warned us to expect a terrible fiscal crisis within 2 years unless we adopted their plan. The crisis hasn't materialized, but they're nonetheless back with a new version. And in case you're interested, after last year's election, in which American voters made it clear that they want to preserve the social safety net while raising taxes on the rich, the famous fomenters of fiscal fear have moved to the right, calling for even less revenue and even more spending cuts. But you aren't interested, are you? Almost nobody is. Bowles and Simpson had their moment, the anus horribilis of 2011, when Washington was in thrall to deficit scolds, insisting that, in the face of record-high long-term unemployment and record-low borrowing costs, we forget about jobs and concentrate exclusively on, quote, a grand bargain, unquote, that was supposedly, not actually, settle budget disputes forever after. That moment has now passed. Even Bowles concedes that the search for a grand bargain is on life support. Let's convene a death panel. But the legacy of that year of living foolishly lives on in the form of the sequester, one of the worst policy ideas in our nation's history. Here's how it happened. Republicans engaged in unprecedented hostage-taking, threatening to push America into default by refusing to raise the debt ceiling unless President Barack Obama agreed to a grand bargain on their terms. Obama, alas, did not stand firm. Instead, he tried to buy time. And somehow, both sides decided that the way to buy time was to create a fiscal doomsday machine that would inflict gratuitous damage on the nation through spending cuts unless a grand bargain was reached. Sure enough, there is no bargain, and the doomsday machine will go off tomorrow. There's a silly debate underway about who bears responsibility for the sequester, which almost everyone now agrees was a really bad idea. The truth is that Republicans and Democrats alike signed on to this idea. But that's water under the bridge. The question we should be asking is who has a better plan for dealing with the aftermath of that shared mistake. The right policy would be to forget about the whole thing. America doesn't face a deficit crisis, nor will it face such a crisis anytime soon. Meanwhile, we have a weak economy that is recovering far too slowly from the recession that began in 2007. And as Janet Yellen, the vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, chairwoman, I beg your pardon, of the Federal Reserve, recently emphasized, one main reason for the sluggish recovery is that government spending has been far weaker in this business cycle than in the past. We should be spending more, not less, until we're close to full employment. The sequester is exactly what the doctor did not order. Unfortunately, neither party is proposing that we just call the whole thing off. But the proposal from Senate Democrats at least moves in the right direction, replacing the most destructive spending cuts, those that fall on the most vulnerable members of our society, with tax increases on the wealthy and delaying austerity in a way that would protect the economy. House Republicans, on the other hand, want to take everything that's bad about the sequester and make it worse, canceling cuts in the defense budget, which actually does contain a lot of waste and fraud, and replacing them with severe cuts in aid to America's neediest. This would hit the nation with a double whammy, reducing growth while increasing injustice. As always, many pundits want to portray the deadlock over the sequester as a situation in which both sides are at fault and in which both should give ground. But there's really no symmetry here. A middle-of-the-road solution would presumably involve a mix of spending cuts and tax increases. Well, that's what Democrats are proposing, while Republicans are adamant that it should be cuts only. And given that the proposed Republican cuts would even be worse than those set to happen under the sequester, it's hard to see why Democrats should negotiate at all, as opposed to just letting the sequester happen. So here we go. The good news is that compared with our last two self-inflicted crises, the sequester is relatively small potatoes. A failure to raise the debt ceiling would have threatened chaos in world financial markets. Failure to reach a deal on the so-called fiscal cliff would have led to so much sudden austerity that we might well have plunged back into recession. The sequester, by contrast, will probably cost only, and that's in quotes, around 700,000 jobs. But the looming mess remains a monument to the power of truly bad ideas, ideas that the entire Washington establishment was somehow convinced represented deep wisdom. And that was by Paul Krugman. And it appeared in the Daily Historian this past Monday in the, of course, opinion section. Well, I'd like to read another editorial from the Daily Historian to finish off the day. It's somewhat in the same subject, and it's from Tuesday, which is where I read the earlier budgetectomy article. What about the rest of us? Congressional pensions are obscene. Slowly we are learning the extensive impact that budget sequestration will have on the nation. Here at the mouth of the Columbia River, the U.S. Coast Guard and National Park Service are a major presence. Budget reductions under sequestration will range well beyond direct federal employees into the schools and welfare. It is safe to say that members of Congress had little clue just how extensive would be the impact of sequestration. Economists are predicting a cost in gross domestic product. In each of the congressional office buildings, it would be useful to hang a large banner asking this question, what about the rest of us? We live in a nation that contains a permanent government class. Those well-paid and well-pensioned men and women live in a world apart from the rest of us. Demographers have picked up on the shift in wealth that has occurred. Three of America's wealthiest counties surround Washington, D.C. They are wealthy because of the contractors and consultants who have benefited from 10 years of war spending. Those nation's capital, headquarters of the permanent government class, was insulated from the recession. The congressional pension system is the most blatant example of the permanent government's otherworldly benefits. Bob Hotakainen of McClatchy News Service reported on Monday that former Congressman Norm Dix of Tacoma will receive an annual congressional pension of $107,268. Dix's monthly check from the federal government will be $7,365.82. Let us stipulate that Mr. Dix was an excellent member of Congress. He had enormous positive impact on our region over a quarter of a century. But the congressional pension system, the source of Dix's new largesse, is an insult to working Americans. Hotukkanen quotes Pete Sepp of the National Taxpayers Union, who says this is one of the most generous pension programs ever created. Pensions are largely a thing of the past in the private sector. That's one reason why the congressional pension is jarring. The size of the system's payouts, such as to Mr. Dix, are obscene. Our Constitution says that America will not have a royal class, a nobility, but we're growing one in the permanent government class. And that's an editorial from Tuesday, February 26th. What about the rest of us in the Daily Astorian? And, of course, some other government pensions are causing havoc in this state, the PERS, and especially its effect on schooling and school funding. Well, this has been Michael McCusker on this very sloppy, rainy day, which I feel like I'm just nothing but a blur of water having walked here from my home. I might see you next week if I don't fall into the river or one of those drones, unvoted for drones, incinerate me on a sidewalk.